طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This Week in Palestine has been covering the ongoing conversation concerning the intersectionality of the movement for black rights in the United States and the liberation of Palestine from its occupation by Israel. We return to this theme this week with civil rights activist Daphne Muse, who delivered this presentation as the 2020 Edward Said Memorial Lecture to the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center. Said Arakat joins her in conversation.
For this year's Edward Said Memorial Lecture, we are very pleased and honored to have with us Daphne Muse, who will be giving a talk titled The Intersections of Our Resistance and the Legacies We Leave Future Generations. We're also happy to have with us Said Arakat, who is a longtime accomplished journalist, analyst, and professor, and is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Palestinian Al-Quds Daily newspaper, and also a member of our Palestine Center Committee. And he will be moderating today's event. Thank you both so much for joining us today. In our Edward Said Memorial Lecture today, Daphne Muse will discuss the similarities and intersections between Palestinian and Black struggles for equality and justice, as well as their implications for the future. Muse is a writer, poet, cultural broker, and veteran of the civil rights movement. When she was a teenager, her parents seeded an enduring bond with the people of Palestine. She became an activist while a student at Fisk University, working with the anti-war movement and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Her activism evolved, during her time managing Drum and Spear Bookstore and while serving as a secretary to the legal defense team for the Angela Davis trial. Her essays, reviews, and social commentaries have appeared in scores of publications, including Black Scholar, The Atlantic, This Week in Palestine, and have been aired on NPR. As a writer, lecturer, retired educator, and in partnership with the Imagining America Consortium, she continues to mentor activists and creatives around the world, and she has lived in Northern California since 1971. Without further ado, I will hand it off to Daphne Muse.
Thank you so much. The intersections of our resistance and the legacies we leave future generations. I sincerely wish to thank the Jerusalem Fund Palestine Center for inviting me to give the 2020 Edmund Said Memorial Lecture in a year more than any other now determining the fate of Palestine, my own country, the United States, and the overall future of our planet, Mother Earth. Said's visionary courage and intellect brought a truly clarifying lens to how the boots of imperialism and settler colonialism crushed so many efforts to seed a viable future for Palestine and all colonized peoples. My heartfelt thanks also goes out to poet Edmund Garib for putting my name forward and rekindling a transformative connection that was made in 1970. As he sips his black coffee from the Afterlife Cafe, the spirit of my father extends gratitude for inviting me and my 98-year-old mother, who to this day is a devotee of Yasser Arafat and reminds me of the responsibility that comes with this honor. On the shores of the Mediterranean Sea at Gaza, teenage boys surf, sit, and sometimes sleep, seeking refuge from the ravaging, pillaging, and poisoning of the land on which they live. They often speak in hushed tones for fear of the waves carrying their voices back to the Israeli soldiers stalking and uprooting the land where their ancestors planted olive and fig trees, the legacies they wanted them to inherit. They speak of their dreams of joining the World Surf League, becoming rappers or engineers rebuilding the infrastructure of their country, or the alchemists of resistance who pull a single thread that can unravel the most massive tapestry woven with lies, treachery, and the lethal knots of settler colonialism. In Hebron, girls work alongside their mothers preparing mansaf, bamia, and fried green tomatoes, a beloved dish in Black cuisine as well. They too study hard to realize their dreams of becoming cellists, doctors, astronomers, and future leaders of their country. Like the boys in Gaza, they navigate a maze of Israeli police security checkpoints to sit before teachers who give them treasures of knowledge. While Black children don't have to navigate checkpoints, many live in neighborhoods where the lines of racial demarcation are clear, and members of the Movement for Black Lives, parents, elders, and community members escort them across barriers shaped by racial and class policies in places like Ferguson, Missouri, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Thousands of miles away at the shore of Florida's historic American beach at Amelia Island, a social refuge for Black people since 1935, families listen to their young speak in animated tones of becoming intergalactic surgeons, directors of Afrofuturistic films, historians documenting social justice movements, and city planners bringing back Black communities destroyed by the architects of white supremacy. Many live where walls obstruct their dreams, and screams from their nightmares far too often pierce the night air as blood and bodies flood the streets from Gaza to Louisville and Ramallah to Rochester. The children whose ancestors were human cargo on slave ships that crossed the Atlantic were born into whirlwinds of struggle and resistance mounted by 19th century abolitionist Harriet Tubman, 20th century poet June Jordan, who sing a song of Palestine, pays tribute to Arab feminists, and now the veterans of civil rights movement. And this generation of Palestinians are standing on the shoulders of 20th century freedom fighters, including Ribhi Muhammad and William Nasser, and the organizations including the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, that wage parallel struggles to secure Palestinian independence, to secure Palestine's independence as an autonomous state. In 1964, Malcolm X met with the newly formed PLO, while many of our esteemed writers, including James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, and so many Black people who work along with Palestinians at car manufacturing plants in Detroit, have stood in solidarity with the people of Palestine. This generation of Blacks and Palestinians are coming into formation on the beats of Beyonce, Palestinian rappers Shajib, plus Al Nathir, and scholarship and activism of the co-founders of Blacks for Palestine, Christian Davis Bailey, and scholar Dr. Najime Ali. The tradition of alliances and intersections runs with Fred Hampton Jr., legendary artist Twista, and Rebel Diaz hosting an Existence is Resistance benefit concert for Palestinian youth. Historically and presently, there are clear parallels between the oppression suffered by Blacks and Palestinians, from racial profiling to the incarceration of youth to whites-only roads, neighborhoods, buses, housing, and school. White supremacy in the United States closely resembles the occupation of Palestine. Companies like G4S profit off the racist mass incarceration of both African Americans in the United States and Palestinians in Palestine. And while our cultural luminaries have aligned themselves with this struggle, so too do thousands of others. Kathy Shields, who works very closely with the Middle Eastern Children's Alliance, noted, "Black Lives Matter sent representatives to Palestine and Hazem as director of Shuruk, a community organization in Dashe refugee camp near Bethlehem, and met with them. Following the murder of Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of George Zimmerman, Palestinians were among the first to send messages of solidarity to protesters. When Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005, Palestinians from Dahesh refugee camp sent donations to help with relief efforts for the Black community. My own commitment to Palestine was forged in my parents' home when I was in the ninth grade. Both were working class civil servants engaged in what I have now come to recognize as discrete resistance. I developed a passion for geography and at one point wanted to be a cartographer. My mother, Betty Goshen Muse, was a clerk in the passport division of the State Department. She brought home interesting stamps and brochures about other countries. Among them was one about Palestine. I have no recollection of the specific contents, only that I was intrigued by the shape of what Palestine was at that time. Dad had a day job as a clerk for the Department of Defense. In the evenings and on weekends, he worked as a private butler, as an invisible Black man in settings where the voices of world power discussed their strategies for political and personal conquest at dinner parties, embassy receptions, and bastions of patriarchy, including the Metropolitan Club, considered the most exclusive club in the country. My father knew a coup was going to happen before it hit the front pages of the Washington Post, overheard the orchestration of coming wars, and witnessed the political and personal indiscretions carried out by power mongers and ruling class elites. Without going into specifics of what they heard or often saw in their jobs, they discussed current events in the vernacular of Black working class people, noting that Palestinians were treated just as horribly as we were. And Yasser Arafat was an icon in our home. Whenever he came on the evening news or 60 Minutes, where he appeared with some frequency, or was reported on in the Washington Post or Christian Science Monitor, my parents' refrain was, "And what did Yasser say today?" His appearance in the U.S. media was frequent, and he was defiantly charismatic. I began to think that maybe Palestinians were our secret cousins. My parents also followed the commentaries and reporting by Kentucky-born Helen Thomas, who would go on to become a senior White House correspondent. Her expertise on the Middle East was invaluable, and Dad would see her at parties he served across town. In one of those that is the way my life rolls stories, she and I became instant friends after meeting at a book signing in 2009. She even invited me for dinner at the press club in 2010 for the State of the Union address. During those 4 years, we packed a lifetime of friendship over long conversations and our ever-growing concerns as to the very precarious future of Palestine and her in-depth knowledge of the Middle East. I transformed my parents' discreet resistance, though, into activism and onto other platforms, including incorporating works by Palestinian writers in curriculum projects on which I worked across the country and into the multicultural children's literature course I taught at Mills College. Also, for 22 years, along with troves of Black picture books and young adult fiction, I handed out children's books instead of candy at Halloween, including those by prolific poet and author Naomi Shihab Nye. Feeling compelled to reflect on so much that we have in common, I also use my voice to write a series of articles for This Week in Palestine, including one on the intersection of Black and Palestinian comedians. My home became an oasis in the diaspora, where strategy sessions for social justice movements were conducted for writers, artists, filmmakers, and activists who sought refuge or whom I hosted to perform, including a prize-winning poet, Alice Walker, prize-winning poet, Gwendolyn Brooks, activist, Afeni Shakur, and her son, Tupac, civil rights icon, Rosa Parks, and Palestinian poet and artist, Manar Harb. But long before meeting Thomas, my most unwavering solidarity with Palestine came in 1970, when Drum and Spear Press took the radical step of publishing Enemy of the Sun, Palestinian Resistance, an anthology of Palestinian resistance. The voices of Naomi Shihab Nye, Nasir Arouri, and Tawfiq Zayad resonated powerfully, introducing a more global relationship to their works. In the 1960s, poet and editor Arouri, who went on to become an internationally recognized scholar, activist, and expert on Middle East politics, United States foreign policy in the Middle East, and human rights. Edmund Garib, now a journalist and senior scholar at the Palestine Center of Jerusalem Fund for Education and Community Development in Washington, D.C., had been inspired at a conference in Beirut to collaborate on editing this anthology. Guided by their vision for the future of Palestine and a mutual passion for poetry, after a series of rejections, the book was taken to Carl Senna, an acquisitions editor at Beacon Press. 3 weeks after his enthusiastic response to the manuscript, he told Garib and his colleagues that Beacon would not publish the book. Senna suggested Garib and his colleagues take the manuscript to Drum and Spear Press. This small independent press was based in Washington, D.C., and founded in 1968 by Charles Carb Jr. and a devoted cadre of fellow activists from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. On the heels of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the rising Black Power movement, which awakened the consciousness of the city and country, Anne Forrester Holloway provided the kind of leadership that resulted in the publication of the anthology. I managed the day-to-day matters of the bookstore at the time, and the modest press run of 10,000 copies became a bestseller. It became part of the curriculum at the University of Massachusetts and was added to the personal libraries of prisoners across the country, including Soledad brother George Jackson. A copy of the book was found in his cell after he was murdered. Their vision and perseverance resulted in a powerful literary victory. And within a year, that anthology was published. It became a launching point for the voices of a generation of Palestinian poets including award-winning writer Naomi Shihab Nye. Sami al-Qasim's poem, Enemy of the Sun, echoes the intersectionality of the civil rights movement, African liberation fronts, and hundreds of post-colonial liberation movements across the globe. As reflected in the sometimes searing and poignant poems, the Palestinian people are complex and dynamic as any other nation of people, determined to claim their history and land from the claws of oppression. 3 weeks before he was murdered in an explosion, Ralph Featherstone, who managed the bookstore at the time, and in that particular moment, I will always treasure, he introduced me to Ghareeb and two of the other editors of the anthology. Repeated harassment by the U.S. government forces, most especially the FBI, who assigned me my own agent, Jim South, and the running of a business based on what I call capitalism, with whom the store's core vision did not align, resulted in the closure of the press in 1971 and the store in 1974. The title poem in this elixir of poetry encapsulates the intersection of historical and contemporary movements demanding that Black Lives Matter and Palestine become an independent state under the governance of its own people. Enemy of the Sun by Sami al-Qasim. I may, if you wish, lose my livelihood. I may sell my shirt and bed. I may work as a stone cutter, a street sweeper, a porter. I may clean your stores or rummage your garbage for food. I may lie down hungry, O enemy of the sun. But I shall not compromise, and to the last pulse in my veins, I shall resist. You may take the last strip of my land, feed my youth to prison cells. You may plunder my heritage. You may burn my books, my poems, or feed my flesh to the dogs. You may spread a web of terror on the roofs of my village, O enemy of the sun, but I shall not compromise. And to the last pulse in my veins, I shall resist. You may put out the light in my eyes. You may deprive me of my mother's kisses. You may curse my father, my people. You may distort my history. You may deprive my children of a smile and of a life's necessities. You may fool my friends with a borrowed face. You may build walls of hatred around me. You may glue my eyes to humiliations, O enemy of the sun, but I shall not compromise. And to the last pulse in my veins, I shall resist, O enemy of the sun. The decorations are raised at the port. The ejaculations fill the air. A glow in the hearts and in the horizon. A sail is seen, challenging the wind. And the depths. It is Ulysses returning home from the sea of loss. It is the return of the son of my exiled ones. And for her sake and his, I swear, I shall not compromise. And to the last pulse in my veins, I shall resist, resist, and resist. In 1971, while I served as a secretary for the legal defense team for the Angela Davis trial, Palestinians stood in clear alliance with her, and reams of letters poured in from Palestinian activists and prisoners around the world. Davis broke ranks with the Communist Party USA, who had been ardent supporters of Israel, and has become an unwavering ally to the Palestinians through her work in collaboration with other scholars and activists, including Blacks for Palestine, Mecca, and the movement for Black Lives, despite farcical so-called peace deals. Robin D.G. Kelly, a leader within the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, through his scholarship and activism, has challenged the myth of security that has resulted in miles of walls and fencing deterring Palestinians from moving freely within their own state. But mine is a personal story of how I thought of Palestinians as my cousins and the legacy I inherited from my parents, where their discrete resistance became my creative resistance. So know that there are millions of people who are not versed in the philosophical or ideological discourse of resistance, but whose moral compass points them on the road towards liberation. In these times, the quest for wholeness and compassion are real. For living life on what seems like the hourly brink of extinction deprives us of the visions, creativity, and inherent powers that allow us to breathe. I will not be dispossessed of my country, nor should my secret cousins, the Palestinians, be of theirs. At the very core of my soul, though too often gripped in the platinum pits of hell, where the forces of imperialism, 21st century colonialism, and racism are trying to remand us permanently, Edward Said's words have become my daily mantra. Humanism is the only, and I would say the final, resistance to have against the inhuman practices and injustices that disfigure human history. May his words and the refrains of allies, human rights, and anti-Black racism organization serve as anchors at the Mediterranean and the historical waters of the Atlantic for those committed to bringing their visions, practices, and commitments to social justice, anti-racism, and all the debilitating dogmas leading to the destruction of humanity and this planet on which we get to be in this most sacred and at times truly beautiful ritual called life. The dreams of those boys in Gaza surfing at the sea, the girls in Hebron doing complex math computations and striding with the stance of leadership in their spine, and the teenagers at American Beach are due that rightful inheritance that their ancestors planted as a legacy for them. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Daphne. That was really quite compelling. If I may, Muhammad, huh?
Of course, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Thank you, Daphne. That was quite compelling and quite touching. And more importantly, it really just laid out the commonalities of the struggle, the same pain that Palestinians and African Americans may feel, and you know, the camaraderie and the struggle, the pursuit of freedom, and the pursuit of to escape violence that is imposed upon them for no other reason than racism, basically, and the exploitation. You mentioned a great many wonderful human beings in the American Black community, the African American community, the leadership, and so on. You mentioned names that are friends of mine. I just want to go over Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, who was a very close friend of mine. We were, you know, definitely comrades and close friends all throughout. You mentioned Angela Davis, and I remember distinctly when Angela Davis basically broke away from the Communist Party at the time and supported the Palestinian struggle. So I remember that. I mean, it just, you raised so many things for me that are really personal. In many ways, you know, and whether it's also the struggle as a student and all these things, you know, my forays into Oakland and Compton and many other places in California or Chicago or in Milwaukee or many, many other places all throughout the past so many years. And, I look at this and I look at the violence that is being inflicted on African-American men for being Black. In this country, I mean, I look at since George Floyd, there's been something like 100, lots of killings of African Americans and so on. This year, I think there was 164 killings of Black Americans for no other reason except for being Black, and just raises, you know, the image of in my own community, my own family, only a month after George Floyd was killed, was murdered. The same thing happened to a young relative of mine at a checkpoint for being a Palestinian while driving, you know, 28 years old. So the similarities are amazing. You know, I can't breathe, you know, just raises all kinds of images. And my question to you, I mean, you raised so many issues. I'd love to ask you 1,000 questions, but I wanted to ask, despite all this commonality, there seemed to be an element of disconnectedness between African-Americans and Palestinians. There's somehow, despite the commonality, despite, you know, the struggle that is really strikingly similar, what we see there seemed to be, you know, or at least for the Palestinians, there seemed to be a missing link, so to speak, in terms of reaching out to Black Americans and solidify that struggle and basically produce the kind of results that we all want. So I want to go back to your issue of intersectionality. And where are these gaps and how can we overcome these gaps?
Well, I think, first of all, the context of, I want to clarify that the time that my parents ceded Palestine in my spirit and my mind started in the 50s, went through the 60s and 70s, and Palestine was covered in the media very, very differently at that time.
Right.
And because of, I think, the charisma of Yasser Arafat, because of his charisma, the coverage, and an interesting little point that a lot of people don't know about. One of the largest Arab community in the United States at the time I was growing up was Detroit. And I think that still may be true. And there was a lot of connection between Blacks working in, especially the car plants in Detroit. Mm. And so there were places where there was interaction, there was social interaction, political engagement, and also at the time emerging in the 60s, you had the voices of people like Stokely keeping Palestine on the minds of people. But I think that part of the irony of this situation is lots of Black people go to Jerusalem, Black Christians, and they go, and it's as though the Palestinians don't exist. They don't talk about interacting with Palestinians. They talk about their the Christian experience that they have, the pilgrimage. So in far too many ways, Palestinians have been rendered almost invisible. And some of it, I think, much of it has to do with the pillaging of the land and the fact that even though you have social media, which provides instantaneous connections for people, it has been that the walls that keep being thrown up make it much more difficult for those alliances to maintain a kind of strength and a bond that I wish could be seen. And again, the media coverage of Palestine as a terror state is what most people see. They do not get to see the day-to-day lives, the aspirations, the children playing, a country trying to hold on to what it has and build a future, but at the same time that is debilitated by the destruction of settler colonialism on a daily basis. So that's part of it. And I also think that the overwhelming conditions of the United States right now makes it even more complicated for those alliances to be built, and that you don't have the strength of a black press that needs to exist in order for a different kind of coverage to take place.
And that could be a counterbalance for the Zionist evangelicals that are a base of support for Mr. Trump and Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. That could be quite effective. I have lots of things to ask, but I think Muhammad has questions from people who are watching and listening. So go right ahead.
Yeah. So we got a couple of questions that you've actually addressed. But for example, how can black people and other people of color increase their awareness of the Palestinian struggle as well? But and I think you touched on that as well. But another thing that was asked is you mentioned that your parents influenced your interest in the Palestinian struggle. And was this interest common in the black community, or was this rather atypical?
You know, I'm not certain. I just don't. I don't have empirical data to prove that. But what I do have is within that, my father was part of an organization called the Private Butlers Association. Mm-hmm. Those men heard so much state secrets because they were invisible men.
Right.
And they would, at parties, you know, family gatherings, they would have these, again, they didn't go into, they were discreet, but they had their ways of through codes and, man, you know, it's jacked up what they're doing to the Palestinians. Why? And they would, the conversations would carry curiosities forward for me and make me dig deeper into reading about Palestine. And again, a lot of that was based on, I wanted to become a cartographer, you know, a map maker. And just seeing how the world was configured and why certain people lived in certain places that they lived and how they lived. So there was a lot of discussion among the people who were a part, who were connected to my parents. Again, they did not speak in the sophisticated terms of the ideology or the philosophy, but just as everyday working class people. And so it really set something in me early on. And again, the parallel between, and what inspired me to become a creative activist based on my parents' discreet activism. The world really is, as there was a Ray Charles, it's not the title of a song, but it's a phrase within a song. The world is in an uproar and the danger zone is everywhere. And the danger zones just implode on a daily basis, and it just makes it so much more difficult. But what I would say to parents is bring the world to your children. Bring the world to how it really rolls for everyday working people who are trying to make a way out of no way. Because the voices of the elite, the voices of power are heard all the time. The voices of people who comprise a country, who make it, who really make it work, those are the voices that are diminished on a regular basis. So as parents, as cousins, as friends, as educators, we can play the role in seeding future generations on how the world, the axis on which the world really should turn.
Another question is, if you can touch on this, is can you say more about the similarities of day-to-day life between black people in America and Palestinians?
Yeah.
I think that the most, unfortunately, the most obvious are the ongoing killings of people, the daily, almost daily murder of black men and women here, and obviously the same thing in Hebron and Gaza. And I just want to point out an irony. I'm not recalling his name in the moment, but a couple of days ago, a young black man was murdered by a policeman,
right,
a 22-year-old cop. This black man was an ardent advocate of the police. And according to media reports, a Trump supporter. There's so much irony that rests in that. But I also think I've never been to Palestine. I've always wanted to go. Circumstances just never made it possible. But I have interacted with Palestinians here in the United States through the arts, through culture, through the activism. And there is a kind of joy. There is a kind of, despite everything, we're going to live. Despite oppression, despite the enslavement of my ancestors, despite the atrocities placed on the necks of Palestinians and their children on an almost daily basis, there is a will to resist. But as I tell my friend, Mary Louise Patterson, I say, it's like toothpicks trying to fend off tanks. And there's a weariness that comes with that. But there's also a resolve that comes with it. And I think that that resolve is manifesting in the poetry and the art of this young woman that I have mentored for a couple of years now, Manar Harb, that it is now manifesting in the desire for this. I read a recent article about an 11-year-old Palestinian rapper who's rapping about peace between Palestine and Israel. These children want peace. They also want their country. So that's some of the joy, the way we commune around food, the way we till the land. I mean, the fig and olive orchards, are as precious to Palestinian farmers as the watermelons and corn and rice in the southern parts of the United States to black farmers who are diminishing. Well, for a while, we're really diminishing in numbers. And now there's been a real upsurge in black farming and a number of black women are becoming engaged. So the respect for the land is also something that we share in common. And the traditions that are anchored in the respect for the land, from planting on it to holding rituals on it, we share that. And the creatives, the poetry, the art. I think one other thing I would like to highlight, that the contributions that Palestinians have made to the world are so underestimated and not honored, that there are a number of Palestinians involved in the tech world. And one of the things that This Week in Palestine has done is that it really looks at the currency, the current temperature of the artists, the tech people, the educators, the scholars, and so that the global pulse of the Palestinian people and what they have contributed to the world needs to be of greater focus and deserves greater attention in the same way that Black people have had to push through every kind of barrier imaginable to have not only our voices heard, contributions that we have made to the building of this country and that it is built on our backs.
The young man that you mentioned in Texas was Jonathan Pryce that was killed by the police.
Yes,
ma'am.
Yes.
I had, of course, the opportunity to work with SNCC as a student, you know, way back then, you know, Students for the Nonviolent and so on. So it was a different time altogether. But I wanted to ask you, because this being the election season, the emergence of progressive congressmen and women, you know, and potential congressmen and women, you know, so, like Ayanna Pressley from Massachusetts, who's a bona fide member of the squad, or you know, Jamal Bowman, who won an amazing primary against Elliot Engel, a very profound pro-Israel member of Congress for decades and so on. So that was a big thing. Or, you know, Cori Bush in Missouri. I mean, there is an emergence of Congress men and women, progressive, you know, vocal supporters of the Palestinians. How is that likely to impact the conversation within the African-American community or in the intersectionality of Palestinians and Black Americans?
I think it's having slow but meaningful impact that there are members of Congress that are willing to stand up for the Palestinians that are being flogged mercilessly by the Israelis. And the various PACs and organizations that wield unbridled power in this country and around the world. And when people see, even if it's incremental victory, those victories become stepping stones for something greater. The fact that you have millions of people registering to vote at this point in time is significant. And there are innumerable efforts to sabotage the election. And it's going to be a hard, there are going to be many ways in which it'd be challenged. But I think the voices of Pressley, and people in the squad are rising and people are really listening to what they have to say. And that these people are coming to the table saying something really meaningful. It's not just political babble, but it is transformative, not only conversations, but legislation that is being proposed that can result in change. And they are getting some significant coverage and they are having impact and they are aligning themselves with grassroots organizations, because all too often those who claim these victories then forget the organizations that launched them, that made it possible for their voices to rise. But Pressley and others are standing with the grassroots organizations that have moved them forward. And I think, again, because of the way things get covered in the media, there is a lot more, there are a lot more alliances than people realize. And also there are people who will never say a word, but they support. And they don't say a word because they know they will lose their jobs. They know they can be murdered. They know their children can be removed from them. But they, in ways that we don't even imagine, they are there standing in solidarity. And they're not going to raise their hands and say, I gave $100. But they're going to keep giving that $100. They're going to keep writing the letters of support. They're going to keep organizing in underground ways that some of us just can't even imagine. And that's essential. That's essential.
Absolutely.
And every victory, there should be a victory chart that every time there's a victory for Palestine, every time there's a victory for Blacks in the United States, that chart should just flow with all the victories, because I think we feel we are not accomplishing anything because we're so overwhelmed by the travesty of those squatting at the White House and corrupting efforts to have countries that really function based on sound political principles and that allow people to bring their voices forward and make the changes that are essential, not only to Palestine and the United States, but that are essential for the future of this planet.
You have been listening to Daphne Muse, delivering the 2020 Edward Said Memorial Lecture to the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with the ongoing struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم